When you think of a human being with two distinct personalities, you immediately think of Jekyll and Hyde, one good, one unspeakably evil. When I think of a man with two personalities, I think of Michael Pennington and his alter ego, Johnny Vegas. Neither of whom are evil, both of whom are beautiful and benign. One, a capricious troublemaker in flares who's prone to making elaborate ceramics, and the other, a thoughtful, kind, majestic human being. I love both of them, but this interview was conducted mainly with Michael. I love the fact I'm speaking to you, and it's a really sort of upward, sort of sharp upward tilt you've got on your camera. So you look like this sort of almost like a kind of Marvel character against some sort of bifold doors.
Bifold doors and a pinball machine. You know, just going.
Is that what it is? Could
it be more redneck looking? I have the most affordable midlife crisis. I tried to buy a retro pinball machine, and then a friend of a friend befriended a guy who lent me this. I've loved playing it, but it is called The Walking Dead, so it's not really something. It's not a very apt title for this.
Well, it's not motivational. It's not. It's not the sort of thing you want to see every day, is it, at the moment?
No, but then I have been planning for the zombie apocalypse. I sadly have to admit.
How have you planned? How have you planned? What are the tools? Say I wanted to plan. What's the checklist?
One which I have to I yet have to do.
Here he is. Come on, settle yourself.
I have to learn how to hotwire a boat.
A speedboat.
Because. When I'm in London a lot and out in Richmond Way, darlings, we've worked out we either get into Kew Gardens because we've got all the seeds to repropagate. We've got the space. We've got the high walls.
Yeah. So you're basically gonna jump the wall of Kew Gardens. You're gonna break into their heritage seed laboratory. You're gonna start tipping them out into open ground.
Don't really think it through.
We need to go step by step because there's some lapses in the procedure for me that are critical.
Yeah, you're going, that one looks like it needed a greenhouse.
For example, what happens, right, if the zombie apocalypse happens, I don't know, say October, November, that's not planting season for most things.
If I can't get to Kew Gardens, yeah, but it's got the highest walls and it's got a lookout point. If I can't get to Kew Gardens, I basically steal anything I can from the Sainsbury's and get down to the river and hotwire one of the tourism boats.
So you're going to be going
just
around.
Just buy myself some time.
So you're going to be sort of going sort of loop de loops in a tourist speedboat with a stash of sort of nicked shit from Sainsbury's.
Yeah, you know what's nicer than the glass top boat when you want to watch the world go to.
All right, I'm going to put this to you. I mean, they're all good tips, don't get me wrong, and I feel increasingly prepared. What happens
when you say that, but you rub your forehead in that way?
Is it a cue? Is it a visual cue?
That reminds me of a casting years ago. You only realise and you're going, but within comedy, when you're meant to be good at sort of judging body language.
Yeah.
When you have a director take his glasses off and hold the bridge of his nose and go, thank you. I've never worked out.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I've had that a bit.
I still thought I was in with a chance of getting the part.
What was the audition? What was the part?
I've told it many times. It was Lord of the Rings.
Oh, God. I've not heard that story. I'm sad. Come on, tell it briefly. I want to hear it.
It was just dreadful. It was the first casting I ever went for, and I kind of wasn't bothered. And then four castings later, I read for Peter Jackson and just didn't have the tools in the shed, you know, to have the conversation about, you know, I've read scripts. Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah, I really think the root of this character is.
Yeah.
And he basically went, right, I had to read this scene where Shelob, the giant spider, is burning down. And he went, giant spider. Attacking you and your friend, what do you do? And I was like, get off.
So you were basically you're a complacent hobbit.
Yeah, I was. I bet he plays it at Christmas parties and stuff. It was horrendous. And when I left, he said, have you got any... I think he really wants to go, come on, show me something. He said,
yeah, give.
Do you have any questions about the character? And I went, well, I haven't got very big feet. His voice just trailed off as he went, yeah, that would have been prosthetics.
Oh, did he leave a space at the end? Just a nice silence.
Just that pause as he leaves. Yeah.
But why didn't you prepare? Was it almost too big? I sometimes feel if things are too, like, I don't know, too much pressure, or they have the potential to bring too much good, then I self-sabotage.
I can't do castings. I really admire, oddly in a way, you see, I've directed and it's frustrating, but you know the people that say, I'll not come in and read, either offer me the parts or don't. But my thing is, the minute you get into that room, that part of your brain that takes over, you know, the awful sort of, you don't know this. You don't know this. I once went and read for the part of young Oliver Hardy, and I've never done as much research. And I got in the room and something happened, and I turned him into a Brummie. I can't do a Brummie accent if I tried. But this thing,
but you were channeling Brum.
What don't you do something to help me? It's like that. And it was audible. And I came out and there was a guy, young actor, who looked the spit of him, and he dressed up with a tie and everything, and I called him a name as I walked past.
What?
I know, I'm sorry. It was just...
You sledged a fellow actor?
I did.
Man. Oh, man.
No, because it was a bit where you're like, I'm done with acting because I can't do castings. I hate them. I love them.
What did you say to him in case he's listening and he can get his apology now?
We began with a W and I think we can finish it off ourselves, can't we?
Yeah, okay.
I didn't like, not right in his face, but I just sort of said it like...
Could he have heard it though? Was it an audible aside?
I think it was meant for him to hear.
Oh dear.
That's unforgivable. It was pure frustration. At my own, not having the tools in the bag to, you know what I mean?
I find, I've not done many castings, but I find the scrutiny unbearable. And suddenly, the squeamishness of trying to pretend to be someone else overtakes me.
Yeah.
Do you get that?
Yeah. Do you not think as well that you go, look, once I'm on set, it'll all feel very real and I can do this.
Mm.
But being in that room with somebody who's reading the lines back to you really flat.
They're not looking at you.
Yeah.
And trying to work out which sort of adult spotlight photo is yours. You know, because like for me, I'd be going for the part of a mother or a grandmother or a great-grandmother or whatever, and it'd be just like a sea of sort of brunette, middle-aged sort of spotlight women. And yeah, they're just trying to think, oh, God, which one's she? It's so demeaning. It's so... I always feel in the situations that I'm just wearing my pants.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's proved to be true.
But you know what? That the only good thing I've learned from it is being on the other side. So when I've directed and you've been casting yourself, is try to get back to the people directly. Because that's the other thing that they don't tell you, you haven't got the job, do they? So
no, they don't.
A lot of times you just suddenly say, oh, it's kind of head, it's been made with obviously somebody else.
Who got your part in Lord of the Rings? Well, who got it in the end?
Oh gosh, what's his name? The American actor. And when I watched it, I actually sat in the cinema going, I could have done better. I didn't know they wanted a kind of cod. Oh no, Mr. Frodo, oh, you can't be having, you know. And
had you gone in with Brummie? Had you gone in with to Peter Jackson with a Brummie as well?
All carry you.
Wondering to bind them all.
The darkness bond.
Oh, look, this Schmeigel.
Oh,
dear. So I need to know the name of the actor now.
I know he's and again, honestly, I hope you know I'm not that bitter performer who envies, you know what I mean, other people's careers or anything like that. I've always been very like, you're doing what you're doing, you're in your own moment, you know what I mean, you're not chasing anybody else's career. But I did watch the DVD with the extras, I won't lie, it gave me a bit of comfort that he directed a short film within it, which was terrible. And you just got the sense that all the cast were really fed up with him because he was he came across as very much a know-it-all, you know, like telling the helicopter pilot how to land in snow.
Was it Sean Astin? Is that who you're thinking of?
Yes.
Who I think has appeared again recently, went very quiet after the Lord of the Rings, and then I'm sure beloved listeners will correct me. Exactly. Turned up a much changed man, I thought. Didn't recognise him.
And was his dad an actor or a director?
I think his dad was Steve Austin, the $6 million man.
His dad directed $6 million.
No, his dad was Steve Austin, the
Sorry.
It didn't deserve it, don't worry. It should have been. No. You gave it what it deserved, which was a befuddled, bemused silence. I'm Googling. This is amazing you can do this now. I say amazing. You've always, well, for a very long time, you've been able to be on a call and also Google at the same time. Right, his dad. Right, let's look him up. Michael Tell, I think his dad was.
I'm sure he comes from like an industry family, do you know what I mean? Who've got a track record within.
Right. Yep, he's an American actor. Yeah, John Alan Astin, an American actor who'd appear best known for starring as Gomez Adams in the Adams Family in the 1960s.
Yeah, right.
There you go. We've learned something. This is a very deep dive, a much deeper dive into Sean Astin's career than I thought we'd get to.
And do you know what, by all, I'm one of them, I've never met the guy, and I don't know, it was just one of them, at the time, it was something that went from nothing to huge, and like you say, I couldn't have blown it any worse than what I did. And for somebody who's not competitive, it's just how...
it's brought out darkness, hasn't it?
When you walk out of a casting, just going, that was possibly the most embarrassing thing I could have done while still fully clothed.
I guess it's the opposite of doing stand up, isn't it? Where you feel, even if you're having a terrible gig, that it's all on you. You can change it up. You can be the master of your own destiny. Where if you're in a room with, and sometimes there are 7 or 8 people in the room.
Yeah, it's well, you know what? Again, funny enough, the worst. I went for the casting for The Voiceover years ago. And that's another one for, I can't believe it's not Butter. It was disastrous, but when you're doing like VO stuff and they have 8 ad execs in and they're behind that glass and they go into a huddle talking, my brain just goes to a very horrible place going, they hate it. You know what I mean? They must.
Yeah. But what they say is so weird. I've done voiceover. I remember doing one and a guy said, could you, that was great. They would say, that's great. But there's always a big but. That was great. Wonderful. Great. Could you make it a bit more citrusy? Citrusy.
It's honestly, just again, I don't want to bore you with stories I've told before, but my first ever experience of going in a voiceover studio and the director's there, and it was an animated piece, and I was reading for the part that I was reading for the lead, the butter that's not butter.
You were the main Pat.
Yeah, I was the man. And he said, oh, just do a straight read, please, and I read it, and he came back. And it's the best note, like the most unattainable note I've ever been given, and I honestly thought it was an Anton Deck wind-up at the time. He came back, bearing in mind, this is an advert, I can't believe it's not put in. He came back and he went, yeah, this time, could you try it with intrigue? Imagine you're Michael Caine in the Ipcris Files.
Oh, that's a great reference, though.
And that was a note. And I almost said to him, well, I don't have a nail to push into my hand whilst I'm...
He would have provided one had you said that.
I ended up doing a really bad incidental, again, not intentional, Michael Caine impression. And I was just ushered out. He just went, thank you.
You were only supposed to spread the batter on. Not just batter, it's sort of like batter. It's kind of, I can't believe it isn't batter. Can I just ask, though, in a butter commercial, or not, a margarine commercial, why they wanted intrigue? Why did they want intrigue in the mix?
You know the line that he wanted intrigue for?
Yeah.
me, I mean, it was sexist to say, two corn on the culture passing by, and I had to say, go on, girls, rub it into your kernels.
Sorry, you'll need to say that again, because I was stunned.
Go on, girls, rub it into your kernels. So he was obviously a builder. I can't believe it's not butter. And he wanted that with intrigue.
But why would you be intrigued? A bit, you're intrigued by something somebody said to you. You're not intrigued by a statement that you've authored. How is it even possible? It's like being a particle in a wave.
Well, that was... Try explaining that to your mother on the phone outside. Did you get the gig? And you're going, no, I didn't. And she said, why? And I said, well, I can't make a blend of vegetable oils and fake butter intriguing enough. And that's when my mum went, is there any other parts? And I went, there's a disgruntled boiled egg. And my mum went, oh, you'd have been perfect, is that? Go back to your minutes.
I once played an animated pigeon. And then in the audition, there were many, many auditions, but one of the first auditions, they gave me a character sheet which said Maggie the Pigeon is a regular gym goer. And I literally didn't know what to do with that level of anthropomorphization. I just sat there and I just felt my will and my common sense just ebbing. Everything just ebbing away. So I could just, it's like the Matrix. Everything just stripped down to virtually nothing. Just code.
It comes about, like you said, as a stand-up, you're the master of your own destiny, downfall or otherwise. But with pieces like that, again, I've done classes where... did you go to drama school?
No, God, no. You can tell, though, there's no training there. It's very loose, very loose.
No, because I've seen people come in and read. And again, without being rude, for the lack of talent, I so admire the confidence.
Sometimes there's a different relationship between
the two states. It's learning how to schmooze. I read for Harry Potter. I went in to read for Harry Potter for the shrunken head on the night bus.
Can I just ask? Presumably you made it Brummy.
Had to, didn't I?
Of course you did. Whether you wanted to or not, the Brum will come in. It's almost like a stress response.
I'm Sean Connery and I have no range. You get the voice.
So what did you have to do with the shrunken head? What was the audition?
Well, thing is, it was meant to be in a kind of Caribbean voice. And do you know, it was the nicest casting I've ever been to, because some director, we talked for about 50 minutes. And then at the end, he said, do you want to read? And I went, is there really any point? I went, I'm not right for this. And he went, no, not really. But thanks for coming in. And I'll never forget Sean Locke saying, it's like being on Bullseye, isn't it? When you get on, you have it, the chat's great. And then they go, shall we read? And you almost go, no, I'll just take my tankard.
Yeah, I'll just... You're all right, thanks.
Let's leave it on a good
note.
But
why weren't you right to play a disembodied head on a bus?
Shrunken head on a... Well, again, because I don't do accents.
But why did they want a Caribbean accent? Why didn't they pick a Caribbean actor?
I don't know. I think Lenny Henry did it in the end.
That seems more appropriate.
Completely sense. I think they cast the net wide. Do you know what I mean? It was that thing of let's just...
They wanted a bit of St. Helens in the mix, I think. They'd looked at the roster of performers and they said, we're just missing a whiff of St. Helens.
Well, the PR people were going, why isn't this film just landing in St. Helens? We need to draft it.
Have any films been set in St. Helens?
How can we have him in the film? Yet not in the film.
We need more St. Helens.
People, I imagine phones going in LA. We're crashing in St. Helens.
Have you heard of St. Helens?
You know the place where they play that rugby league?
It's in the northern England.
Yeah. I'm they're Googling it furiously going, apparently it's they make a lot of glass.
Is that what it's known for?
Yeah, we're built on sandstone. Town based on science. So we have Pilkingtons. We
Pilkingtons. Didn't know it was that's
in the head. Do you remember the little birds in the bottom of your glass?
Yes.
Maidenhead, that was here. UGB. All more or less, sadly, now gone away. They developed in St. Helens fibre optics. We basically, essentially assisted the world in terms of the internet.
Bloody hell, why don't they make more of a thing out of that?
No, they did. They've just a lot of manufacturing has moved overseas, but they came up with the idea of sending technology down a piece of glass.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by our friends at Gymshark. Gymshark, if you haven't heard of them, it's a conditioning brand dedicated to creating functional training apparel, designing innovative performance technologies and building passionate and empowered communities. Formed in a garage in Birmingham, UK, Gymshark has emerged as a leading brand in the industry with a worldwide family of over 15 million people in 150 countries. They exist to unite the conditioning community, and I'm now of their number. Gymshark's functional training apparel is perfect for when I'm following an online class or out fast walking. I'm afraid my days of jogging are well and truly over. Whether it's their flex leggings or seamless sports bra or their hoodies, which are ace, the Gymshark catalogue is great and it looks great too. You can check it out for yourself, gymshark.com/Sue Perkins. Gymshark also work with creators and athletes such as Ross Edgley, Katie Taylor and Whitney Simmons, to name only a few. Gymshark are creating a community devoted to unlocking potential, united by conditioning. To learn more, check out their website at gymshark.com/Sue Perkins. How is St. Helens faring in lockdown?
It's like everybody else, it's struggling, but in community-wise, I think it's been absolutely phenomenal. It really has. I know lots of people saying it, but it's just brought out the best in everybody. Yeah. I think we're not very good at sort of waving the flag for ourselves, but I think it's reminded us of just how strong a community we are and how much, you know, how far we're willing to go to help each other out.
It's a shame that you have to find that out in adversity. I always find that strange about humanity.
No, it is, and look, it's my hometown, and I love it, but without, you know, going too far down that route, we voted out for Brexit, which bitterly disappointed me. It really did, and it was one of them, should I have been back home, and should I have been on, you know, a soapbox, and should I have been...
The thing is, I think the soapboxing doesn't make any difference, I think. You know, it broke my heart too, but that's where we're at. And we, you know, and I sort of, my only worry now is that we don't no deal Brexit and the economic fallout of that gets swept under a general pandemic, recession and collapse. But what interests me out of all of this is how quickly the system bottoms out. So the system we live in, with all our debt and our constant purchasing and constant stimulation, if that gets switched off, then you just tumble into a sort of monetary freefall. I mean, most people are just a paycheck away from having nothing, and that's not a sustainable system, is it?
No, it's not. But do you not? This was always if you get into a political decision, because that, I think the only thing I found a little bit. Not a little bit, that's really sort of got to me through this. You saw the thing of, you can afford to go because you're a celeb, and you go, no, it's not the case, and it's been really good being back here and working, do you know what I mean? Just getting out there and doing stuff within the community. This is why I do this, I lose my thread all the time. Sorry.
I do that. I've got lockdown brain. Don't worry about it.
But if you get into a discussion, a political discussion, say, and they go on about the winter of discontent, and you go, how far back was that? And how many times has capitalism failed? And we bailed it out, and it's allowed to fail, and we bail it out. And yet, one period back in the 70s is still referred to straight away of, we don't want to go back to that. Do you know what I mean? Oh, the horrors. Do you remember?
And yet no one talks about 2008 when bad debt was packaged and sold on to make money. I mean, wasn't it a banker's away weekend? They decided that they could run out of ways of making more money. And then they thought, no, hang on, we just sell on a ball of negative shit.
If you have any kind of socialist principles, it's like you're the bogeyman. You're the one who's coming to steal everything, you know, take everything away. But
in a way, what you're doing, and what I'm hopefully trying to do in my community is just, for me, and I'm an anxious person when I think about the state of things, but if I focus on the micro, like just what's happening in a few streets around me. So I start to know who's homeless, who needs help, who needs food, whose mental health is suffering, who's on their own and can do with a smile or a wave or a bunch of flowers at the door. And it's through those pounding the streets, maybe only just like half a square mile and really getting to know it, that I find myself calmer and able to cope with it.
Well, it's so interesting. Honestly, there's more people I've spoke to within our profession. It sounds really selfish. I've never slept better.
That's interesting.
I haven't thought about showbiz once. And the last time I spoke to you, I was not in a very, you know what I mean? I wasn't in a very good place. And I'm sort of going, do you know what? I get in that thing of doing something real as opposed to, without sounding like I'm being hippie or anything, but just being out every day and talking to people, like you say, within your community.
Yeah.
Opening up a bit of food and seeing the difference it makes, having a 10-minute chat and finding out that they was a friend of your dad's or this or that. It's my job. I always find something to feel guilty over, but I feel so guilty that in some respects, I'm in the best place I've been in years. Just by being amongst this community and like I said, doing something, feeling like you're doing something practical that you can give back rather than, you know, will you retweet this? Will you do that? So
yes,
whether you're not getting involved, it's not patting yourself in the back, and it's not in any way to promote yourself. It's just going, I feel like a St. Helens again, and I've loved it. And it's like some cloud has lifted from me that I've been carrying around, you know, living in London. And I'm not anti-South, not anti-London. It isn't that. It's just in a difficult couple of years, and we're losing both my parents.
Yeah.
I honestly feel like this has given me an opportunity to heal a fair bit.
But maybe being, you know, as you say, you lost your roots. And quite literally with your parents passing, and then added to it, you're in a foreign county. It's good to go back home. And I also think, because I'm trying to be optimistic, the human beings are essentially good. And I think if you pursue a selfish path, and sometimes our jobs are very selfish and self-serving, that it sort of dims that part of you that needs to be fed. And the greatest reward is just doing something without needing anything in return. And there's such, sometimes if I'm making a batch of cheese sandwiches for the local homeless population, I'm so lost in a sense of genuine mindfulness and calm. I'm just grateful for the opportunity to do it and that it might be of some good.
It's that, you know what, it's a thing of going, my life has been packed away in a studio, what was meant to be a studio there. Going through pictures, framing stuff, making my house look like it's somewhere that's lived in, you know, giving it some personality and having the time to pore over those pictures and not be back for half a day and have a kind of OCD-like thing of going, oh, what if you put that picture up and it's in the wrong place?
Yeah, it was interesting because you were putting online, it really interested me. You were asking people where to put the picture up, and I thought, there's a man who's a bit like me and doesn't really know. Because our jobs are quite, you're here, there and everywhere, you're touring. You know, here's a man who doesn't know how to make a home, maybe. I don't want to put that on you, but I've felt that about myself for so, so long, until really recently.
Well, it was, and life's, you know, turned up very differently. And I envisaged, when I got this house, being in this house, raising a family in this house, You know what I mean? Always being Saint Anne's based. None of that has panned out. And there was a little bit of, we got all the main building work done very early on. And then coming back, it was just, for years, it's just been a very blank canvas that I've not had the time to be here and sort of get to know it. And it's always like I've always been moving or I've always been shifting stuff and everything's always been in storage. It's like, you know, transatlantic, my life's coming out of storage and I'm enjoying stuff again. And I'm just putting stuff on the wall and I'm not listening to the thing that goes, it's got to be perfect, it's got to be this. Like, with the house now, I'm going, for years now, I think from being an art student, I wanted to be an old deco and I wanted to be minimalist and this, and you go, but you're not, and you mess up and your brain has, you know, 20 ideas a minute. Let the house reflect that.
Yeah.
And what is horribly morbid, I think there was a bit of me going, well, if anything ever happened to you, because of your lifestyle or anything, the house would be easier to sell if you don't put your...
No, did you really think that?
I think I did. I think it's there under...
Subconsciously.
It's a former... Yeah. I think it's a hangover from my hypochondria years, which I don't have now, but I think it was that thing of, oh, it would be much easier to shift if it didn't have your stuff all over the walls. Whereas now, I'm walking past walls and I'm finding reasons to smile. I've got postcards that I've kept for 30 years from the Cree shows and stuff, and I'm finding bits of inspiration on every wall, and I'm loving it. And I know.
Are you potting? Are you getting back to the ceramics? Are you feeling you're more creative?
I want to get the house done. I've got the clay here. I've got the wheel back in place. I'm desperate to get building. But my thing is, get the photos up and get the artwork done first.
I think it's amazing. You're sort of reconstructing yourself in lockdown. Yeah. You're putting your mark on things. You're making something permanent. I suppose that's what it is, isn't it? It's like, well, I don't feel I have a right to... not exist, that's too strong, but to leave my mark. I'm really glad that you feel you can.
Yeah. It's been a slow journey from watching American Pickers and going, you are a hoarder. Accept it. Stop living. No, but you know, when you go to somebody's house, I was always impressed if I went to somebody's house. My downstairs toilet has become such a project, and there's almost like a story wall of my opinion of stand-up and what it is to be a stand-up. But I'm loving putting it together. I'm going, it probably won't make sense for anybody. It's almost like hieroglyphics.
So it's drawings of fragments of memories of stand-up?
It's postcards. It's this. It's greeting cards I've held on to that I just go, that sums that bit up a bit perfectly. It's all sorts. But I always loved it when I went into, like I say, if you just go into a living, you go, this has got personality.
Yeah, it's true.
It isn't. Do you know what I mean? Just that.
I want a minimum. I like the minimalist aesthetic, right? I love to go into those sorts of houses, but I can't live like that because I'm scatty and messy, disorganized. But I'm at that stage where I have put most things up and most things away. But I noticed the other day there's four pictures that have been in bubble wrap for 18 months, and it's almost like they're the last vestiges, and I can't. Because what if I have to move again, or what if actually this means that I stay in and I'm trapped?
I think
it's insane.
It's part of the, you know, I bought this, I got this place up here, but I've moved that often in London. And I think it's that root thing of the comic of going, well, if it all goes wrong, do you know what I mean? Or if the next thing doesn't come in.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's an intrinsic sort of fear of putting down roots.
Because you know that you have to go where the money is. Because
of that. Of chasing the next gig or chasing.
Never leaves you that insecurity. It's really weird. We're both lucky. We're comfortable and sorted and so bloody lucky and privileged. But that underlying panic about, I've got to get my ducks in a row because it's all going to go. Everything's going to disappear. It's constant quicksand, isn't it? Even though the reality is you're on solid ground.
Well, it is. And more people can rely on you.
That's also very true. And
you don't resent it. It's a lovely thing if you can become that. It's a very odd thing if you've gone from black sheep in terms of like creatively to suddenly, do you know what I mean?
Holding it together.
It's lovely. I have my niece living with me because she's trying to finish her fine art degree. That was a thing of going, I've got the room, move in, do you know what I mean? Please finish your degree.
Yeah.
It's arse. Please don't, you know what I mean? Don't fall by the... And then I come back and she hasn't hung the pans on the right hooks. And I'm thinking this was a huge mistake.
How long is she still there?
She's actually at my parents' house with my brother. She's self-isolating with them.
Where are you in the pecking order of siblings? Are you the eldest or the youngest?
I'm the youngest.
I don't know much about the psyche of the youngest. I'm the eldest, so I always relate it to dogs. So for me, the eldest is like a collie, permanently exhausting itself, going, you all right? Are you okay? Is everyone all right? So I'm going to go to the room, make sure they're all right. I'm going to bring you all into one room and check you're all okay. And I always think of the youngest being, Mel's the youngest, and I always think of the youngest being a slight show dog, in that they're just so beautiful and so beloved. But it's interesting, you're probably now helpfully proving me wrong.
I think I've trashed that theory, haven't I?
I know, you are both of those things. You're all those things.
Yeah.
So what's the psyche of the youngest then, tell me, because I've just...
I'm always very resentful. maybe it's true and I'm in denial. No, but a lot of people go, the youngest kid has always seen as, like, I'd say within my family, definitely, that I was the one who got it easy.
Yeah, I'd say in my family, my sister got it easy.
You know, when you're the youngest, there's things like, you'd be amazed how many sort of family photos, how few there are of me because the novelty's worn off. You know, by the time you... Honestly, yeah. Just give me one... I'll show you this now. Sorry,
Sue. No, go on, I love it. Go on, get it. I like the show and tell. I wish everyone could see it, but I'll do my best at an audio description. What I'm loving is... I'm loving the mop on the... Just to remind me how clean you are. This sort of loose little mop placed against by the bifold.
I will hold my hands up. I've not done my own cleaning for... So, where's it gone? Because behind you there... Behind the iPad is a sea of photographs. Why can't I find it? I've literally been framing stuff all day and now I can't find it. But it's a picture of us all in a photo booth. And the only evidence of my presence is...
an ear.
Just squeezed out.
Yeah, there's only... photo booth is only...
Right around the young comic.
Do you know, I remember that. Was that an Edinburgh poster?
That was potentially going to be the Edinburgh poster.
I've seen that image. So that's basically a young Johnny Vegas, in full pomp, leather box jacket, car jacket, some beautiful flares with what looks like a velvet panel at the bottom, with a baseball bat. Was it gold?
Yeah. Of course. Swinging it at a TV. Whereas now I go into a commissioner's office and just drop to my knees and go, please.
I somehow don't think so.
I don't know any other way. back in the days.
Always off, hang on. What are you getting now?
That was always my thing as an art student was, if I can't do this, do something else. Do you know what I mean? And it was suddenly... really weird a couple of years ago. I remember having a discussion with a friend and going, it's the first time I've ever felt closest to being institutionalised of what else would I do if I didn't do this. And I'd never had that.
And when did you feel that?
I always wanted to be willing to sort of walk away if it wasn't, you know what I mean? It just didn't feel right. And then now... it was that kind of, what else would I do?
I have no transferable skills. None. I mean, I've learned to crochet. I speak sort of pidgin Spanish. I like crafting, and I'm pretty competent. But you can't make it. You can't. What can you do with that? You can make the world pretty, but
yeah.
So I can do art. I can do arty things. But yeah, I sort of worry. And I suppose at the moment I worry more because arts in general is pushed so low down the agenda for this government. Well,
that's why I said to my niece moving here, do you know what I mean?
Before she misaligned your pots and pans.
You've got to finish this, because it's that classic thing of, again, without, you know, too political, but it's, like sports, like a lot of things, there'll be kids that can afford to do it, and the best ones are out there. But there's no way I could do a ceramics degree now. There's no way I'd do it to borrow that amount of money.
Yeah.
To go and do that, you know. And at the time, it was like, oh, I pay my taxes, so you can make bloody ashtrays. And you go, it's a bit more of a broader course than that.
I always have this thing that I just think that they should do. And it would be the first thing that I would do if I was Prime Minister, which is I would say, I'd abolish all fees. But you have to, if you want your fees paid by the state, then you have to do 6 months. Everyone has to take a gap year, and 6 months of it has to be spent in a community setting doing voluntary work.
Yeah.
So the people that haven't already learned it for whatever reason can learn empathy and learn what it's like to be an elderly person in their community or somebody with special needs in their community. And then they can spend the rest of the 6 months, I don't know, getting smashed out their sort of brains on a beach in Thailand, but at least they've done something and they know, like what we're doing now is marking out those streets and where there are pockets of need. They would have done that at 18 and then their brain is plasticized for empathy and care, and then go and knock yourselves out. It's never going to happen. But that would be my, I get really, because I've got nieces who are approaching that sort of time where they're thinking about going to college, and the idea they're going to be priced out of it just breaks me.
Well, here's the thing. Do you think... It sounds like I'm going off track here, but I'm not. I also find... You know, we talked about being the youngest earlier.
Yeah.
But how do you feel when you go, I am absolutely fascinated how siblings can be so different when raised in the same environment.
Yeah.
So with something like empathy, is it upbringing, or is it something that you are naturally born with, or is it an incident in your life that makes you more empathetic towards other people? You know what I mean? Because some people just don't have it, and
no.
I don't want to make that a thing of poor versus. It isn't. It's just some people don't genetically seem to be lacking in other people's welfare.
I don't know what it is, whether some sort of self-interest kicks in, whether they can't deal with it, whether it's too, for some people it's too much, I think. Some people think, if I open the doors of perception on what's going on, then it will overwhelm me. Because some people are too porous. I'm a bit like that. I hope I've got a lot of empathy, but I feel very, very porous. And if I'm around people who are struggling, then it, after a while I have to decompress because I feel it too much, and then I become basically useless and of no help to anyone and self-pitying sort of tool. But I always want to think that the empathy is there, but people have either blocked it willingly or through just a perversion of society upon their soul, you know. But I don't know. I think it feels like it's something you learn in childhood, only because I know that I learned mine in childhood. I know that, you know, every parents have got their flaws, but they were always mindful to teach us about other people, other communities, other faith, you know.
My dad was, and I, you know what I mean? I my parents, both of them, sorry, not so bad, but I totally think if there's any good qualities to me, I got them from my mum and dad.
Me too. All the best stuff's from my mum and dad, and all the worst stuff is shit. It's quite possible. Just the endless struggle to push your own ego to the fore, you know, this, it's constant, you know, even though you don't want to think of it like that, maybe that's all it is, just...
Yeah, it's the I've always said it's the arena of the unwell, isn't it? Though when you end up in stand up,
I think so.
What draws you to that place to go, I want to take all this pain and share it.
Because I think you want to be For me, it's like you want to take things that are difficult and put them in a manageable format, which stand-up is the perfect format, particularly the Edinburgh show. But then you want them, more importantly, after you've packaged it in a way that you can accept your own narrative and your own history, to make people listen. So I always sort of feel when people struggle in our game, it's because no one's listened to them. I say this with as much finger pointed towards myself. It's like, maybe we just need to have some more therapy. Or, you know, if you pay someone to listen to you once a week, do you suddenly lose the need for an audience? I don't know.
Well, that is in itself, isn't it? It's that other fear. And I don't know if it's true. I don't know if this is the things that just ends up out there. Was it John Cleese that said he got therapy and then he no longer?
Well, it's funny.
Because once you take that sort of darkness or fear away, the urge to please or to...
See, I don't think the darkness or the fear ever goes away, but I think what therapy does is sort of help you manage it.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, I can be a real dick when this happens. So I'm going to try and find I'm going to try and reroute the neural pathways. So even though the fury or the upset or the pain or whatever is still there, I just don't take it out on somebody else. I'm a better person, if not in my own head, then outside my own head.
Yeah, I'm shocking. My best friend, long-suffering assistant, Bev, sometimes I'm so short with her and I hate myself for it.
And so why? Is it because familiarity is...
Because she's been purely supportive or she's possibly reminding me of stuff I want to do, and we have been joking about this, but in a sense, I'm... Probably because of a process I've been going through here to do personal things. I know I've got to go back to that normality soon, and part of me's dreading it. And again, that sounds incredibly selfish. I want this crisis to be over, but for me, it's been one of the most important periods of my later life. And it's her job to remind me that I forgot I was doing the podcast tonight. And that was the thing. I was like, oh, thank you. I've started this barbecue and it's overrunning.
Oh, that's what I was like. You hadn't reached peak temperature for the burgers. It's like, tell Perkins, she'll be all right. Tell her she can hang on. Sometimes I think, though, that you save the... And I feel this about myself, that... I don't know what it is. You can be pretty sharp with people that you really, really love. And I wonder if it's because subconsciously you think, why are you here? Why do you seem to care about me? You know that I'm not worth that, so I'm going to have to attack you now.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. I've had that. I've had exes throw the theory of you surrounded yourself with yes people, which really scares me, because I would hate to think it's that kind of, you know what I mean?
Well, we share an agent, and I have to say, she's not a yes person. She's a put a red hot poker right up your ass person. She fights fire with an apocalypse.
Well, she sweeps the bed. She's already sus now. You know,
she's bypassed you.
If it was a Thomas the Tank Engine story, it would be he's asleep, still sleeping.
I love our agent with a passion, but she does send me emails in caps at 3 a.m. and they frighten me.
Honestly, she has learned that I'm an exit from my dad. It's that thing of I just have to do things at my own pace. I am not a get up and go person. You know what's absolutely bizarre? And I promised myself at the start of this and I haven't done it. I never, ever used to get a shower. This is totally, I don't know why I bring this up. But when I used to think I was busy, I used to do like 2-hour baths. Mm. And now I've not had a single bath since lockdown. And it's the one thing I promised myself on the daily basis.
That you won't have a bath?
That I will have a bath.
But you haven't done
it. I always saw showers as for people who were like, get up and go and, hey, I want to hit the world. Whereas I will get up at least an hour earlier than everybody else because my brain needs time to gain traction. And to just process, you know what I mean? Before I can even contemplate my first conversation.
Yeah, I'm the same.
or dreading that first text of here's what you've got to do today is I'm not bad at isolation.
Are you anxious? Yep. Are you stressed? Always. Do you struggle to focus? Well, who isn't struggling right now? I can promise this will bring a new calm to your day with Grass & Co. CBD. I'm a massive advocate. Grass & Co. is a premium CBD range that blends the highest quality CBD with therapeutic botanical ingredients. I have tried them all and they are brilliant and they will chill you down. The great tasting CBD and botanical formulations have been specially created to relax your mind and soothe your body. So find your lockdown calm with grassandco.com. The best-selling Calm CBD range includes botanicals Evening Primrose, Ashwagandha, Chamomile, Marula and Mint, which will bring balance to your day. To find out more, head over to grassandco.com/hour. If you're new to CBD, the best-selling 500 milligrams Calm CBD oil is a fantastic starting point. As with all supplements, CBD will affect everyone differently. Start low and steadily build your dosage every day so that you find the right balance. I'm currently on about 600, but that's just for me, and I use it regularly to help with anxiety. So as I say, begin low and titrate up to the point where you feel at your most calm. The Calm range brings peace and tranquility to your day with consumable oils, nourishing body oils, and pillow sprays. Comforting aromatherapy scents have been specially blended to quieten your mind and soothe that body. The Grass & Co. complete range delivers exactly what you need when you need it, whether that be taking CBD oil first thing in the morning to prepare for a busy day at work or at the end of the day. The aromatherapy scents can help reduce sleep anxiety and establish the habit of falling asleep. Simply spritz the Calm pillow spray generously over your pillow and bed linen. Inhale the aromatherapy scent slowly and deeply to welcome in a calm and restful night's sleep. Grass & Co. CBD oils contain no trace of THC, which is the part that gets you high. So it's all totally legal to buy, consume, and listeners to this podcast can thankfully get 25% off and free shipping. All you need to do is head over to www.grassandco.com/hour. Simply use discount code HOUR at checkout to claim the 25% off the entire Grass & Co. Calm, Ease and Rest CBD ranges. Grass & Co. is life enhanced by nature. Do you feel claustrophobic when you have too much to do in a day? I do.
Oh, yeah. My brain runs hot really quickly.
Yeah, me too.
A bit like a... What? Ease. Have you found it, because you've been really strange, it was almost like the younger, angrier Johnny was, or this idea of doing non-comedy TV, you know, doing factual.
Yeah.
And now it's something you're going, you get offered factual stuff where you go, but I got offered something like Chasing Storms, and you're going, I've never mentioned the weather. I've never mentioned the weather. In it. I have family. I can't disappear for 3 months chasing tornadoes. I've not expressed.
What made them think, is this is you or Johnny? This is you.
Well, I think it's more that, of course, Michael bleeds in, you know what I mean? It's never been pure Johnny. We used to gig years ago. And the angriness of that. I'd kind of like to bring Johnny back, but in the factual stuff, I don't know if it's old age or whether it's just that different pace of life or whatever, but you're going, quite like factual now, if it's something that genuinely interests me. You know, but I'd have hated myself years ago for doing the factual show.
I think you're in the perfect place, seeing as you're a world away from where you were just when I saw you last, which was how long ago? 6 months ago?
Oh, God, that was, I know.
Jesus.
I know. The show went out last night and I was like, I can't watch this.
I didn't either. I didn't watch it.
I don't like watching myself anyway, but you know.
I've never watched myself. It's a repulsive pastime.
Oh.
But I know what it's like to be in the eye of grief and then to have to go and be public and jazz hands and look at, you know, try and generate something from nothing. It's just, I just saw you in the middle of that in that time. We don't need to go into it any more than that, but I just wanted to crush you with love. Just actually to get you in an arm crush.
I know, but you were lovely because you talked to me afterwards, you know, and it was that thing of going, I think it's nice when somebody recognises that, well, it's not just him being Johnny. No, you know, somebody's intuitive enough to go, you don't seem to be in a great place right now, and you go, well, I'm not. But to even that acknowledgement of it is to be able to say it. Do you know what I mean? And go home and go, it's a classic thing, isn't it? You're not hiding it very well.
But also you're loved, which will be a hard thing. And I don't mean Johnny is loved, although Johnny is loved, but Michael is loved.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. Look, I have found it's life and its ongoing curveballs is when I just, whether I'm the kind of architect of my own downfalls, I don't know, or whether it's just that thing of going, whenever I seem to think I've got life, so something else comes along. And I often ask myself, like, are you addicted to strife?
Hmm.
Or does it just find you?
It's interesting what you manifest, isn't it? And sometimes not consciously, so it's really hard because the time you think, oh, did I bring that up on myself? It's on you. And it's, you know, maybe you are storm chasing. At the risk of being a bit too meta. not in the Midwest, but maybe. Drama's very addictive. The problem with people like us is that we're hardwired for just big adrenaline spikes and then the downers afterwards. The downer of, I want to, whether if the gig's gone well, the downer is, I want that crack again and again and again. And if it's gone badly, the shame. There's been times I could barely lift my head up and look at people because I've just felt, you know, and it's stayed with me.
Would that frustrate the hell out of you that knowing you and the conversation we've had and the conversation we're having now where you go, do you find it frustrating when people sort of view you as supremely confident and therefore, oh, I bet you must love this? As if like you're born to it and you're going, well, again, that's my thing of going, I wasn't born to it. I never wanted to be a comic growing up. Not be miserable, you know what I mean? I'd good laughs, but it wasn't ever a sort of career path that I was looking into. It only ever happened accidentally.
I think I just wanted to listen to people and really understand people and then to, in return, be heard. And that's, so you end up in a career where you're constantly talking and all the rest of it. But as for the confidence stuff, I sort of feel, I don't know what blend of introvert and extrovert I am, but I do know that they're very extreme ends of the spectrum. So I'm either extremely introverted, you know, and I just can't bear noise and I can't bear company and I just need to just calm myself down. Or I'm the life and soul. And maybe you've managed to split those two things with Johnny and Michael. I don't know, but they are both in me. So sometimes it's true that I can be incredibly confident, but I'm also very, very good at pretending.
No, so I have the danger thing of Johnny deals with things in a very, very different way. But you can't live your life dealing with things the way that Johnny deals with them. And as Michael, I am massively susceptible to criticism.
Yeah.
To fear, to all these things. Again, that's obviously how the development of an alter ego is. To fight all your battles for him.
He's your superhero in many ways, but you're right, because Johnny's all output. Johnny doesn't get hurt because Johnny doesn't let anything in. Yeah. He's not on the attack because he's very benign, but he's ranting in loops of brilliance that no one can get into. Whereas everyone can get into you.
Oh, God, yeah, so easily. And again, it's funny with social media and stuff, isn't it, that you let the world in.
We choose that.
You allow people into your life that you would never. There's days like I cannot handle opening or looking at anything to do with social network.
You aren't being mainly loving.
No, it's mainly nice, but it's still that thing of going, you know, it's like in a gig, there's 100 people smiling and one person not. Who are you drawn to?
Yeah. Yeah, and you'll try and win them over and convert them, and you spend all the night.
And then you end up spoiling the night for the other.
For 99 people who go, why was he so obsessed with that dude?
They're not deserving of your time, and you go, you don't understand.
But isn't that something natural that we do in order to avoid? I remember reading something about our brains are hardwired to remember negative things so we don't make those mistakes again. But if you're a performer and someone's just laughing at your material, it's not quite the same. It's not, you haven't made a mistake necessarily. It's just that someone's not resonating with what you're selling.
Yeah, you don't really know. I don't think it was ever an ego thing of you act to like me. It's that thing of what have I done to, I think it's more of a, what have I done to offend you?
Yeah.
I need to know so I don't make that mistake again. I do. I think it almost comes back to empathy.
Yeah, and I think we're sort of overconscious. We're overconscious of what everyone is thinking, because part of a performer's ability involves their superpower. Their only superpowers, they can read that room. They can feel the temperature of it. Who's laughing? Who's not laughing? Whether, as you start talking about something, whether that is going to start to become divisive. And if it does become divisive, how the room's going to split, and how then you're going to try and bring them together at the end so that they've all had a nice time.
Yeah, and it's not that. Did you ever? Sorry, we're funny people, you know. We can be funny outside of this, but
we could be.
Did you not ever notice that thing again? I used to just love people watching. I used to love being on the periphery. I loved sort of Ken Loach films. You know what I mean? Where there was nothing. It didn't have to be a gag. It was just people being themselves, and then. The first time I sort of started going in, and again, I'm not mourning about it. I know how I earn my money. I'm not. But then people are not the souls around you anymore, and you're the one being watched. Yeah. And I really miss being that casual observer in the pub. I really miss just being on the periphery of society.
Has that made
seeing everybody being themselves?
Maybe that's what you're getting out of this awfulness, is that not that you're on the periphery, but at least you're not being watched. You're part of something bigger and greater in the community stuff. You're all the same. Like, and what's really nice for me when I do volunteering is they're really good, the lot that I work with. They're absolutely beautiful, brilliant people. And they've really got the PPE and the all the social distancing sorted. And you wear your mask. And we're all the same. Of course, I believe that we're all the same anyway, but there's no one to sort of, I don't need to get embarrassed or potentially ashamed because, oh, someone spotted this, or they don't like this that I've done, or I'm reading their body language and I think they think I'm a dick. I've got my mask on. I'm making sandwiches. I'm bagging up stuff. I'm singing along to a cheesy radio station with everybody else. With 10 other people from all different walks of life. And I know that we sound like a whinging couple of hams who crave anonymity. We also, but I think it's true, you can say that, we do. But we also crave being, you know, like everybody, a bit different, a bit special, a bit looked upon. And it's all those contradictions, isn't it?
Well, you know my thing is, I like being by myself. No offence to family, no offence to friends. I would possibly, you know, spend as large a percentage of the time by myself if I could. But that's not always healthy, and you process things a lot differently. And without, you know, God forbid, without sounding concerned about it, it's that thing, as you say, when you go in there and you're volunteering or you're doing something, you walk in and they go, is that really the biggest thing you've got to worry about? And you go, yeah, you're right. And it just, talk about putting stuff into perspective.
Yeah.
There's a brilliant sort of, you know, mate, get over yourself. And you go, yeah, you're right. I spent so much time trying to write down what my thoughts and feelings are on this and trying to be funny. And sometimes trying to, you know, you get them ones who, they'll sell a story to papers and then they sell another and another and they've got no left, and then suddenly they sell a really tragic story. where people kind of got bored with them. Yeah. It's a bit like that. We go, oh, which bit of my unhappiness can I mine today to make people laugh? And suddenly going, oh, does it? You know what I mean? You can spend so much time looking for the negatives for what you do for a living that you can become kind of snowblind to the positives. And this, for me, it's just got rid of all the bullshit that's been going on in my...
Yeah, me too.
...in my life of late. You know, it's just clarified so many things. Even when I'm driving and stuff, I've started having conversations with my dad where he's like, was it worth getting wound up over that? And you go, no. Was it worth it? No. You're right.
So your dad's in your head?
Yeah. I'm my mum, but you know what I mean? My dad more of the... You couldn't get a rise out of my dad. My dad was the calmest sort of ambassador of common sense and thoughts and, again, empathy and all these things, but of going... He was my Atticus Finch, my dad was.
Me too, for mine. Dads are heroes.
He really helped me to sort of do that thing of, yes, but why, rather than look at Sturt of him, why do you think he's doing that?
Our dad sounds very similar. Did he take it on, though? Did he take it on? Was he somebody who he saw suffering and he...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my dad was very porous. That's where I get it from.
All these conversations of... give his shoes to a homeless guy, and you know, somebody goes, he's only going to sell them, and he's going, well, there is to sell if he wants to sell them. I've given him his shoes, you know. That's it's not then, I can't give him his shoes and then follow him around policing him.
That's true.
He was, but again, being back up here, I think for 2 years I've been really angry with him.
Why?
I'm walking past. For dying. I've walked past his photos and I've refused to look at him. I've not, you know what I mean? I've not looked at him, and now I am having conversations like he's sat next to it. But I feel so much better for it. That I've allowed him back in, you know what I mean? I've forgiven him for something that he had no control over.
Yeah, I have had that rage, that anger, and I think that the anger I had about my dad was that even as he was descending into a coma, I remember the last things he said was, he just thought he was a piece of shit. All his life thought he was a piece of shit. And he was like a god in my eyes, you know, because he was kind and sweet and listened and never judged. And that's all you want as a kid, is I could have told him anything and he would have just listened and he would have absorbed it and he would have said something wise and kind at the end of it. But when you talked about him, he's like, oh, don't bother talking about me. But as he was on the way out, so close to the way out, he just said, oh, God, I'm so sorry. I'm such a piece of shit and I'm dragging you down. And I just, at the time, I was so busy sort of with my family caring for him. I just sort of would just say, don't be silly, Dad, come on. You know, I love you, blah, blah, blah. I got on with it. But yeah, you get these weird waves. You just think, I wish you'd been able to understand that your qualities are rare as fucking rocking horse shit. And they're disappearing in the world around us. Like, you think about your dad, they're like, it almost feels like a disappearing era, that and each dad or mum that goes that has those values, you just we're a lesser place for it.
Oh, God, yeah, and again, you watch your end, you go, have I managed to pass down any of his qualities that he passed on to me? Do you know what I mean?
I know you will have done.
Yeah, well, it's debatable, but it's I don't know. It's a whole other conversation. You know what I mean? You get into me going. It's funny lately talking to people about that sense of feeling like an orphan, feeling alone in the world, and you know that sense of going. There's now nobody. Nobody on the planet that will love me like those two people love me. And suddenly feeling like a real grown-up. A real grown-up.
I don't want to pass that threshold. One's bad enough. But I do feel what you're saying, even though it hasn't happened yet. The sense of the unconditional. I mean, and that's not to say that I didn't, I haven't fought with my parents and all the rest of it. But you come from me and I will be everything for you. It does, it disappears, I guess. But I suppose if I was a therapist and I'm not trained, so I'm talking shite, but they would say you internalize all that love, don't you? And you're able to affect care from within, to take what they've taught you and the feeling they instilled in you of being loved, and to be able to then bring it to bear on yourself. Hard to bloody do, though. You're still grieving anyway. You can't put this shit into practice for years yet. You're in grief.
No, but I couldn't. It's one of the things where you go, you can be opinionated on it, and you can discuss, and you can be like, I'll be honest, like my empathy levels when somebody loses a parent now is so different from having gone through it, from knowing the right things to say to actually, it's kind of flipped where you're going, look. Do not beat yourself up with how you deal with this. Do not give yourself any grief over, what happens in this period of time. I had a mate who very sensibly said to me at his dad's funeral, he went, it's like a tin of paint that's teetering on the on a shelf in the shed. And it's like, I'll go back and I'll sort that, Move that paint, I should move that paint. And he goes, and I'll either go back and move it, or I'll come in one day and it'll have fallen over with, maybe the shit, the fan, so to speak, or whatever, or the paint. And he went, but I don't know which way it's going to go. And I'm not going to beat myself up over not knowing which way it's going to go. And it is that of like allowing yourself time to, but I never ever thought I could hit the being angry with them thing. You know what I mean? I didn't think it was within me because there was so much love for them. But I've been resentful at them going.
But that's not a real anger. That's
I've
just.
podcast into a very, very sad place, haven't I?
No, you think it's a very real place, which is why I have such deep care for you, because you like me will just go for the real, go for what's present in the moment. And the thing is, what you're saying is universal. It's real stuff. And if this has taught us one thing, this mess is that being authentic is the only true currency. Because everything else just falls. Everything falls. It's a house of cards, the superstructures that surround us. So why not? You're a wise man in a room with a walking dead pinball machine. It doesn't get more arousingly complex and multidimensional. All right, give us, before I let you go to your bed or to whatever high revels you've got planned, take me through, because you queued it up. What's behind the computer? What, take me through the lovely things. I don't want you to reveal something you don't want. I mean, I just won't.
No, it's not, but there we go. It's just photographs
I love this.
and photos and postcards, but
Bloody hell,
then,
there's loads of them.
oh, you think there's loads? There's a box full there.
Oh my God, I've
There's
never
all of
seen.
these. There's all of them that need to be hung. Then we have more. Then we have postcards. We have pictures.
That's a
We
proper
have.
studio right there. You've got proper kit.
Well, there's the potter's wheel, and that's my goal. If I get everything hung, I can get
Are
on
you
that.
making your own frames?
No, God, no.
No, I couldn't
No,
make a frame.
you know what? I'm the son of a joiner, and both my brothers were joiners, and me and Wood just don't get on.
I couldn't
That
do
makes me
it.
sound innocent, doesn't it?
We'll use that as a tagline. And then you'll suddenly get really earnest executives asking you to come in and saying, look, we're really interested in you doing a documentary about a male impotence.
Yeah. Johnny, I mean, it was so brave of you to come out.
And at the tail end of a podcast too. Who'd have thought that would have been the forum? But there it was. I don't get on with Wood. Oh man, it's always, I could talk to you for hours. I'm gonna let you be. I'm gonna let you have an evening. I think you're super special. I really do.
You know what? You too as well.
Thanks there to Michael Pennington with a little bit of additional help from Johnny Vegas. If you've enjoyed this and other episodes of the podcast, I would really appreciate it if you just left a review on Apple Podcasts. As always, all the music in this episode was from Waiting for Smith. You can find him on social media, and why not listen to more of his music on Spotify.
Yes, it's true. When I'm down and I'm blue, all I do is stare at you. I'll be heading east to find my peace where the desert feeds.